At some point, you have probably realized that we spend nearly a third of our lives in bed. That's a lot of time. So let's make every night's sleep the best it can be with Avocado's Green Mattress. All Avocado mattresses are crafted with certified organic latex, wool, and cotton, ensuring a safe, healthy sleep environment free from harmful chemicals and toxins. These luxurious mattresses promote better sleep through breathable, naturally temperature-regulating materials, which can support your overall well-being. No harmful chemicals, just healthy materials for a cleaner, safer sleep. Sarah and I are always looking for opportunities to reduce the toxic burden in our own environment, especially during sleep. Avocado mattresses are better for you and better for the planet. Unlike some mattresses, with Avocado, you can also try before you buy. Visit one of their retail stores or premier retail partners to experience the comfort in person. Head to avocadomattress.com today and save up to 10% on certified organic mattresses. Dream of better. Delicious, meat nutritious. Crack into a good source of protein with tasty, healthy, Wonderful Pistachios. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein, providing all 9 essential amino acids. In fact, each 1-ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios contains 6 grams of protein. Pistachios have got to be the tastiest nut. Pistachios are delicious, they pack a nutritional punch, and are oddly fun to eat. It's like a little dopamine drop every time you hear that shell crack open. Personally, I like them roasted and salted, but you can find your favorite shell or no-shell variety at WonderfulPistachios.com. Whether you're running between meetings or dropping off the kids, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack.
Sofas disable us and chairs disable us is because we can just totally collapse into the sofa's embrace. Whereas, if we have to hold our own spine up or, relying on the ground, then the spine has to use its own strength in order to be comfortable and feel good.
Like, we're always responding to the environmental stimulus. So if you sit in a couch for 7 hours, or whatever, like, you become couch-like, you become shaped like that. And you can kind of visually see it. George Thompson, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast today.
Hey, Les, great to be with you.
I was pumped when I saw you guys reached out. I checked out the documentary you made, The Subtle Art of Losing Yourself. Am I saying that right?
That's right. You got it.
And it was outstanding, man. Job well done.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated the idea of what it takes to put together something like that. It appears that you're all by yourself through that documentary. Is that true? Did you have, is there someone out there holding the camera? Or?
Yeah. So for those that haven't seen the film, it's called The Subtle Art of Easing Yourself. And I'm in the Cairngorm Mountains of Scotland in the deep winter. And yes, -5 or -8 on top of the mountains. And we are looking at snow hares and reindeers and the birds that are surviving out in this really harsh Arctic tundra, basically, in the north of Scotland. And I'm there freezing my toes off, freezing my fingers off. And together we observe these animals and we see, well, they're intelligent. They're experiencing their lives. They're responding to life in intuitive ways. They care for their family, huddling together for warmth, playing together. And we ask the question, well, if they're intelligent, what does that mean about our intelligence and where we come from? And then we adventure through the mountains together to discover our place in the universe and our potential for peace.
Gotcha.
And I position myself not as David Attenborough, as the voice of knowledge. Here are all the truths of our lives. But instead, as a wayfinder, I'm on my way. I'm learning, I fall over, just like many of us do. And what I have found, though, is that we as human beings have an incredible potential. I have an incredible potential. You have an incredible potential for peace, for clarity, for understanding, for wisdom. And so this film, passionately share that. And it's been a huge investment of time and money over the last couple of years. I got frauded and scammed, lost all of my money, funding the team. That was a fun one. And I've kind of called in favors from filmmaker friends. So I did actually have a cameraman behind the camera for this film, whereas a lot of my YouTube is the self-shooting, and I've got fairly good at that. So quite a lot of the shots in the film are me.
I wonder what the cameraman felt about you forcing him to minus 8 degree weather.
Well, he had it harder because, like, he couldn't have his big cold mitts on that I did. So his fingers were, like, freezing off, like literally turning into sausages, iced sausages.
So he holds a special place in his heart for resentment towards you. Well, it's beautiful scenery. It's a beautiful message. I applaud you for your efforts. I'm sure it was a lot of hard work and endured a lot. And it sounds like definitely some challenges along the way that you had to learn more about yourself, I guess, to try to navigate through that.
Yeah, that's how we grow.
What led you to want to make that in the first place, George?
Yeah, so I've started my journey into mindful movement and different ways of understanding myself and my place in the universe really 8 years ago. Although, you know, as human beings, we're curious by nature and always wanting to learn, and I've always enjoyed learning. But when I left university, I descended into anxiety and confusion, not quite sure what I was doing with my life. Thought Kung Fu would make me a stronger man, whatever that means. Ventured to China, to the Wudang Mountains, which is this awesome collection of temples and monasteries and Kung Fu schools and Tai Chi schools. I tried to get into a monastery. That's a whole other story. Failed, got taken to what I thought was a Kung Fu school, turned out to be a Tai Chi school, and found Tai Chi. And I thought, Tai Chi, isn't this for older people, in my ignorance? And I tried it and fell in love with it. And that was 8 years ago. I found Taoism, the philosophy of the mountain, found meditation, and it changed my life, completely transformed how I understood myself. Previously, I thought I was uniquely messed up for being anxious and for finding life hard, and would beat myself up for struggling. And then I found these ancient texts and ancient practices where, wow, the ancient Chinese struggled as well. And these ideas helped me. And so then, yeah, this potential that I talked about at the start, that, wow, actually, I don't have to be like this. Change is possible. Balance is possible. And I've been passionately sharing what I've been learning ever since.
That's great. I was inspired. There was something, I guess I've grown a little detached. I have history also of trying to get in touch with a different side of myself through movement practices, through meditation practices, through connecting with nature, some of the things that you touch on in your documentary. And you did this exercise fairly early on, trying to kind of convey the difference between like thinking and feeling. And it was a simple act. It was like rubbing the fingertips together and paying attention. And I have one of my meditations that I've been leaning on over the last several years is just walking, like slow walks. I am lucky enough to have access to nature kind of out my back door. And it's been very meaningful to be able to, within a couple of minutes, just, you know, be out there. And, but I've kind of grown detached a little bit. I don't want to say I lost my way, but I've started a habit where, I don't know if it's a reliance or just habit, where I got something in my ear. I'm like, you know, we have so much content to take in, and I enjoy it. And I love learning. Like, yeah, you say, we're inherently curious creatures, and I like to learn. But in doing so, you know, you miss a lot, whether you're listening to music, a podcast, a book, or whatever. So the other day, after watching that, I was just on a walk, and I didn't have it. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I noticed things more deeply. Like, I noticed really subtle movements in the pine needles on the tree being like shifty from the wind, and even the sound of the wind, or the sound that my foot makes as it rolls across the ground, which is something that is always there, but I've kind of tuned out, because if you have earbuds and you just don't pick up on those things. And it was a reminder for me, like, oh yeah, I like this. Like, yes, I like content too. I like listening to music, but I don't want to do it at the expense of never having this. So it was a nice personal reminder for me, that that point that you made, and made it very simple to access the understanding of the difference of, like, thinking or feeling and sensation and connecting with the sensations. I think you even put a twist on, it was like, who was it that said, that you mentioned, I think for there I am, or?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you said, that's not the whole story. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that experience. And yeah, it's like, as Alan Watts says, I lost my mind and came to my senses. And our thinking mind is beautiful. It's one of the gifts of being a human being. And yet, without the right training, we can get totally lost in it. And it's not the only way we can relate to life. And there can be a lot more of a soothing and restorative way to navigate life and ultimately the present moment, which is where we live our lives. And yet, if we're stuck in our heads, then we're stuck in the future, planning, worrying, or ruminating about things that happened in the past. The present can be a safe, enjoyable place. So, you know, like, it's not just that meditation is boring. You got to meditate to become a better person. It's like, no, we're actually developing our consciousness to be able to enjoy the richness that is available here and now. So like you so beautifully shared, like, yeah, the pine needles glistening in the sunshine. And then it's the intuitive balance. So, you know, I love to learn. I also listen to podcasts and content when I'm, you know, doing my washing. And then I also have a voice in me that says, no, like, choose silence. And so I'm learning to honor that. So when that voice comes up, there can also be the part of me like, no, I'm enjoying this podcast, but to actually honor it. So then when I'm out in nature and I walk in nature every day, rain or shine, and it rains a lot in the UK, I put on the right clothing and I get out, and yeah, to be in the world. And there's so much richness that can come from that.
You alluded to a moment ago the word consciousness, and I think it's safe to bet that you spent a lot of time or have spent a lot of time thinking about that. How do you define, or what how do you look at consciousness as far as like what it means, where it is, where it comes from?
Yeah. So this is one of the great mysteries. And it's like when, if you're at a funeral and your loved one has passed away, they're in a casket, their body's still there, their physical body that is there, but then there's something missing, which is why, you know, they're no longer with us. And so that, what the Chinese call qi or energy, there's a kind of non-physical energy that is animating life. You know, so say if we look at the brain in an MRI scanner, we can see that if I'm painting, all these different areas of my brain will light up. And that indicates an experience, a consciousness. But it's not consciousness itself. You know, these are just correlations of brain activity with an experience. So to understand consciousness is to understand really the deepest mystery. It's like, where do we come from? What is our awareness? How is it that we are experiencing our lives? And there's billions of animals and other humans that are experiencing their lives here on planet Earth. And what consciousness is, really, there isn't a clear definition of it. So it's related to experience, sentience, subjectivity. In a classic essay by Thomas Nagel in the 1980s, he said, "What's it like to be a bat?" So if you think it's something to be a bat, you know, you think it has a life, then you think it's conscious. So that's how I understand it. Now, in history, particularly in the West, there's been a, in my view, a dogma that consciousness is rational thinking, cognition, analytical thinking. And so Descartes, probably the most famous proponent of that, with his phrase, "I think, therefore I am." So the very fact that he could think in his mind was evidence for Descartes that he was here, he was present, he was conscious. He believed that, you know, he could ignore the sensations of the body. That was not proof that he's conscious, just that thinking. And for him, it was a spiritual thing. He believed that humans, they had a consciousness given by God that then made human beings separate and superior to the rest of nature. And this understanding of consciousness justified gruesome experiments of torturing live dogs, them screaming on the table, and then him in his diary saying, "Ignore the screams, they are merely the creakings of a machine." Seems to me, yeah, much more likely that you are conscious and feeling, and your experience is not just thinking with thoughts, but like you said, with the finger touching, a range of sensations and emotions. And where do they come from? We see there's so many animals that inhibit the same experiences as us, you know, like laughing and playing with their family, snuggling together for warmth, running away in fear. And these are experiences arising in the mind of these animals. Then if we ask the bigger question, well, where does it start? You know, because if it is just nervous systems and brains that create experience, then we've got this miracle happening somewhere in the process of evolution on our planet, that somehow unconscious material created conscious experience. And how that happened is not explained. And yet the current paradigm that still dominates our world, known as materialism, posits that unconscious material, through the process of evolution, created conscious experience. And that is called the hard problem of consciousness. And there's a growing movement in science to say, well, since we are conscious, there's billions of species that are conscious, then maybe consciousness is a fundamental aspect of our universe.
Yeah. Right now, I feel like I lean that way. I mean, it's hard for, because we, to think that it just exists on a spectrum and then we subjectively assign our judgment of which animals are like more conscious and we're the most conscious. Like, I find that hard to believe, that it's almost like arrogant of a human to think that because we have complexities that we don't see across other animals, whether it's like the way we control our environment or such, or attempt to control our environment, which always seems to backfire to some degree, where we don't see another, but to make this assumption that we're at the top end of the spectrum and everything else is kind of lower, and then it dead ends, I don't know, at a rock or something, you know, the other end of the, you know, whatever's above that point where it jumps from the rock-like dead thing to the alive-like thing, whether it's single cell or whatever. But that seems kind of strange, especially like some animals we don't understand. They're so complex, we don't understand them. I mean, you know, look at how an octopus like instantaneously changes all its colors and textures of its skin to, like, I don't know, like maybe it can do it without cognitively thinking, but it's funny the way that we frame it and we look at everything and we don't realize that we're looking it through the lens of our version of consciousness that we're stuck in. So we make these assumptions about, you know, that dog screaming or whatever during the experiment, whatever it's actually doing. I mean, I have always thought when I hear people, I have a client that's like an avid fisher and fisherman, and he doesn't eat the fish, which I never really understood. And, you know, he would do the thing like, well, the fish doesn't feel the hook. I'm like, you're stabbing a fish in the lip and you're making the assumption that it has no sensation of that or whatever.
It's flapping about trying to like live. So, yeah,
it's absurd that we like impose our ideas of it. But, you know, that, I guess you're right. That's what it boils down to. Is it like fundamental or is it emergent? Does consciousness emerge out of, whether it's evolutionary processes or whatever processes that like change in the complexity of the structures that the universe is made of, or is it fundamental or foundational? Everything is kind of, I don't want to say emerging out of it, but is it just being expressed in different like wavelengths or vibrations? And some of those, you know, when they're all mushed together, look like a platypus, and some of them look like carrot, and some of them look like a human or whatever. I don't know.
Beautifully expressed, you know, like, and these are questions, right? Because they're deep mysteries. And yeah, there's something, you know, anthropomorphism is always like, don't be anthropomorphic. Don't say that the turtle comes on the beach in order to lay its eggs. Say the turtle was observed going onto the beach and laid its eggs. You know, you can't purpose as if like the turtle is choosing to go onto the beach. The assumption being that this turtle is just acting automatically without any conscious awareness. So there's anthropomorphism, and then there's anthrodenial, which is just denying the obvious intelligence flowing throughout our planet in so many different species. Just to give you one great example, orangutans. One orangutan was recently observed with a cut on their face, going to then find a plant, smooshing it up, making a paste out of it, and then putting it on its wound. That same plant is used by the local humans as an anti-inflammatory. So, wow, you know, intuitively, this animal has sensed that this plant has a healing property in it. An amazing example. So there's countless examples. You know, just hang out with your dog and tell me that that's an automatic biological machine with no awareness.
Yeah, for sure.
Hang out with them. So then if we if we grant that there is intelligence, then instead of it being a spectrum from like 0 to 100 and we're 100, what about a field of consciousness, awareness, and intelligence? And so then each animal is like a peak on this field. So yeah, we in our cognition, you know, it's taken millions and millions of years of evolution for this advanced brain to be able to create thoughts and stories that arise in our minds. You know, this is certainly a big peak in terms of what life has achieved on this planet. But then, yeah, the orangutan or the octopus, you know, does it need to be 0 to 100, we're better than them? Or can we acknowledge that there's a distributed range of experiences and gifts that have been developed on our planet?
For sure. It also makes me think of like the fact that we have, I don't know, bajillions of microbes that are living in and on us that seem to play a role in how we show up. So like where does ours begin and theirs end, or vice versa? Like how much are we reliant on the relationships of all kinds of potentially conscious organisms or whatever? You know, you mentioned intelligence. It makes me think of the, I guess, I don't know if it's like a dead end in physics, but where as you look at matter and you look closer and closer, and I'm probably going to screw this up, I'm not a scientist or whatever, but you know, they do this experiment and it's like the wave experiment, or there's something to do with electrons where they, you know, they send electrons through, what is it, like the double slit experiment. And then the moral of the story is electrons behave differently when they're observed. So like they behave one way based, I think, on some kind of probability. And then when you look at them, they behave a different way. And it implies that there's like an intelligent observer, which implies there's there's intelligence somewhere in that equation. You know, the fact that these things are organized differently when there's eyes on them.
Wild, you know, because there's always the materialist worldview, which sees, yeah, everything is deterministic. So like we have random particles that bash into each other, and then randomly over millions of years, these have then through the process of evolution become more and more complex, coalescing together. So that's the kind of scientific materialist worldview. And then it still has this idea of stuff and things and particles and matter. And then the more religious worldview is there's a separate spirit in human beings that then animates us. Then we, through science, kept on going down. Okay, we've got tissues, then we've got, yeah, like cells, and then we've got molecules, and then we've got atoms. And we thought, right, atom, we found the stuff, we found the building block that builds up the universe. Oh, wait a sec, an atom is in itself a process of self-organizing relationship with a nucleus and electrons. And then weirdly, when we observe these electrons, they go from a field of potential where they are kind of an energetic potential of energy. When we observe, then they become a particle. And so consciousness, we can't actually then at the atomic level really begin to pin down matter itself, because when we observe it, it changes.
Yeah, it's so weird. And it seems like the majority of matter, like when you look up in the sky and you think of the vastness of the universe, they don't really know what it is. I mean, they put a label on it like dark matter or antimatter, but what it means is like, we're not really sure.
It balances the equations.
Maybe we should lose the arrogance if there's so much we don't know. You mentioned purpose a little bit in context of us applying like a judgment or an interpretation to when the tortoise, I forget what we said, comes on the beach to lay the eggs. I mean, that word, do you feel like there is inherent purpose? Like you did this documentary as if there was at least momentarily for some period of your life, this was some sense of purpose you had that gave you purpose to go through this, to create this, to try to, you know, spread what seemingly a very positive message. Do you feel like we exist and we do ultimately have a purpose, some inherent purpose? And if so, like, does it matter? Does that mean we're supposed to try to find it? Is there like some judgment that you feel like we face that it's like a burden that we're supposed to do? That's guided by whatever that intelligence is, whether it's some organic thing or some entity overlooking the universe, waving a wand.
The Taoist view is a bit different to that. There's still meaning and purpose. is important. And I think firstly, for me, there's a difference between pointlessness and meaninglessness. So, you know, what's the point of life? Where are we going? And our society really benefits economically through this idea that you've got to get somewhere. So, you know, you've got to get the good grades to get the good job, to get the good job raise, to get the good house, to get the good family, to get the good kids, to get the good retirement home, to get the good funeral. You know, the achievement is always in the future. There's a point that you're arriving at. And then eventually, you know, the midlife crisis is when you finally have arrived at the place you thought you'd be happy and content. But because you've always put your happiness in the future, you've trained your heart and nervous system to always find happiness in the future. So even when you arrive, you can't enjoy it. And so I don't think there is a point to life, but then instead, it doesn't mean there isn't meaning in life. And so for me, meaning is a yin-yang pairing of doing and being. So yeah, doing is great. And can it be with the energy of service to contribute? And there's something feels deeply meaningful when we help reduce suffering in the world and we help other people and we feel like we've contributed. So that's still beautiful. And that is, you know, what society talks about. But instead of success, can it be service? But then this crucial second element is being. That this, yes, gift and of life, this great mystery that we are a part of. The story that I read just today, which I really like, is a Buddhist teacher held up a gem, a ruby, like crystal. And he asked his students, like, how does the color change as I move? And like all of these amazing reflections and people saying like blue and orange and green and, you know, people really enjoying the different colors. And then he put down the gem and said, okay, well, what about this gem? And this time he's just holding up his hand with nothing in it, moving his hand back and forth. And then his students were like, there's nothing in your hand. The master then says, well, look, I have this amazing gem, this jewel, this mystery of this body, this being, this moment, this breath, this planet. And you're telling me that you can't even describe the subtle changes in the colors as I move through the sunlight. And so, yeah, we often put the riches outside of ourselves instead of being able to really savor this present moment. And I think, yeah, the analytical brain gets in the way. So like, what's the point of my life? What's my meaning? A phrase that the Taoists love is stop asking why, start saying wow.
That's interesting. You've studied a lot of the, I guess, Eastern traditions, and you mentioned the yin yang a moment ago in regards to the balance between doing and being. I've never really heard of that. I mean, I've heard of yin yang representing balance in some way, but not in that context between doing and being. Is that a common thread in these traditions that you spent time with?
Yeah, the yin-yang is one of the fundamental icons and philosophical concepts of Taoism, and it points to the duality that is inherent in life. So night and day, good and bad, hard and easy, high and low. These contrasts, they come into being together. So there's apparent duality, you know, good versus bad, but you wouldn't know what good is unless you had an idea of what bad is. So there's a paradoxical unity to their creation. And being and non-being, doing and not doing, is one of the fundamental pairings. So if people have explored Taoism, Wu Wei is one of the key concepts. So Wu being non, Wei being action, so non-action. So non-action being paired with action. And so you could say, well, that's doing and being. And what the Taoists point to, and you know, each wisdom tradition has its own gift, and you know, compassion is at the heart of almost every wisdom tradition worth its salt. But then each tradition has something different to offer. So for me, like Buddhism, the Buddha was a scientist of the mind. He understood human consciousness so well that his teachings, like a Vipassana, can really be life-changing thousands of years later. Jesus's connection with the mystery and the loving, unconditional love that can come from that connection, that is what I see as Jesus's gift. And then for the Taoists, it's how do you be natural? How do you let go of control? How do you flow? How do you Wu Wei? And so, yeah, this is one of the fundamental pairings that the Taoists talked about. Confucianism was dominant in ancient China, so they're all about action. To be a good person, you've got to be wearing these clothes, you've got to be putting your meditation mat exactly straight, you've got to be doing these rituals, then you'll become a good person. Then you'll be free. Whereas the Taoists said, this doing leads to contrived ideas in the head that if I wear the hat, then I'm a good person, even though I'm cheating on my wife. Then actually, you need to come into the truth of this moment. Don't try and be good. And through that not trying, then a natural goodness can emerge.
That's cool. Appreciate that little lesson. So how do you, George, implement some of these ideas in your life, like your daily routine or the way you go about being on this side of the dirt?
Yeah. So to hurt is to be human. We have great potential. Practice is the path. So my journey started in anxiety. I thought I was alone in that, but this is part of the human condition. We struggle. And so you're not alone, and it's not your fault if any of our viewers and listeners are struggling at the moment. It's been happening as long as we've been human. And we have great potential. Suffering is something that is part of a human existence, but we can find freedom, not freedom from challenge or pain, but the freedom to experience pain with a balanced mind. That's what these teachings can offer us. So if we're hurting right now and we've got great potential, how do we get there? Practice is the path. So for me, all these ideas about, yeah, my connection to the universe and consciousness, and you know, these ancient intuitions that science is beginning to and has done for hundreds of years to confirm our interconnection. That's one really grounding in my life now, that I feel supported by the universe in a way that my younger atheist self would have had his woo-woo alarm. Woo-woo, woo-woo, get it ringing off. But for me, it's a spiritual connection, if that is a word that works for you. Then the practice is then really training my mind to be able to slow and to find some stillness and to find some clarity. Before, I just allowed my underminer, my inner critic, just to constantly, and I still have an active mind. But what I've learned to do is to be able to hold all of my thoughts and emotions in a bigger space. And as I sit every day, every morning, you know, I clean my teeth, I wash my face after waking up, and then I get straight to my Qigong, and then I do seated meditation, and then I do affirmations, MMA, it's not fighting, it's move, meditate, affirm. Then I, start my day beautifully, and it creates that energy for the rest of the day.
Okay. How much time do you devote to the Qigong practice in the morning?
So my brain, like I'm a morning person, and my brain is most alive in the morning. And so, you know, all the reading and writing and filmmaking I want to do. So, and the teamwork, like 15 in my team now. So generally I have a shorter practice. It's half an hour. And then I do some more in the afternoon. And so what that looks like is around 10 minutes of movement and then 20 minutes of seated meditation. And I find that combo is super beautiful. Qigong, just to warm up the body, to come into mindfulness. Maybe sometimes I'll put some music on and dance, have a track snack, press play once a day, and then seated practice. And for me, the seated practice gives me a clarity of the mind that then supports my Qigong practice. And I think they're very beautifully combined.
Do you use a particular style meditation during that seated practice?
So I have trained in Vipassana and, you know, done 3 10-day retreats. And
for the listeners that don't know what that is, can you take a moment to?
Sure. So like I shared earlier about the Buddha being a scientist of the mind, Vipassana is supposed to be his original teachings, saved in their pristine purity for thousands of years. At least that's what Goenka, who is the person that popularized Vipassana in the 20th century, would say. But it's very beautiful, very simple. The Vipassana, firstly, is about concentration of the mind. So focusing on the air coming in and out of your nose as your anchor for your breath, and really beginning to train your mind to settle. And then Vipassana is about understanding consciousness, this field of awareness that we are, ever-changing sensations, emotions, and thoughts arising and passing, arising and passing. One of the beautiful key insights that we get from Vipassana practice is that there's no separate self, no separate George, no separate ego, no little spirit hiding in this body, like a mote of consciousness, like a little dust of consciousness existing within the body. But instead, we are this field of ever-changing awareness. Vipassanas, they have 10-day silent meditation retreats all around the world where you like get to become a monk for 10 days, meditating from 4:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. No food, some food, but no reading, no writing, no technology, no speaking, no eye contact. And you're becoming a monk for 10 days, dropping into your presence. Very, very life-changing experience.
Yeah, I did a 5-day, but it wasn't all day. So it was abbreviated version where there was a monk guiding. And even that, as a retreat, had a powerful impact on me. I wish it was more lasting. It was like a reminder that we need that stuff. I mean, it doesn't necessarily need to be a 10-day whatever, but it's like because of, and maybe we didn't need it back in the day, I don't know, but in the way like society and culture is and like the speed of it and the flow of information is just so insane and the news cycle and the, you know, all the stuff. It's like, it's probably more important for people to be doing that stuff now where you just, whatever a retreat means for you. And yeah, the little 20-minute sessions mean a lot, but there's something about like really going away and pulling back. And it doesn't mean that you're like rejecting it, but it's like just coming home for a little bit. We get so disconnected from what real like homeostasis in the mind and body is, we lose our reference. And you don't know how far away you are from it. Like there's people that grow up in a city who, you know, never see stars, never see far away, never see into the distance or whatever. And like if you don't have a reference. It's like, and if you're living in a fast paced lifestyle every day, even like when you go on vacation, it's stressful. Like but there's something about like that detaching. I mean, I've done a 5-day retreat where I remember coming home from it and there was a sense of inner calm that was like, there was like an intenseness to the level of calmness, if you will. Like it was just such an interesting experience. And then every day it just kind of went away a little bit more and more. And after a couple weeks, it's like I was probably due for another one. And I had a couple 6-day solo camping retreats where something similar where it was like and that was probably more quiet because I didn't really have people to talk to, and even though it wasn't like structured like the meditation retreat, there was so much down quiet time. And I remember on like day 3, like you'd just be sitting there taking in the environment and you haven't been indoor. Like we don't even realize how much we're affected by just being indoor on a regular basis. And there's something that happens with the eyes where it has these like natural like information that's coming in that's not just 20 feet away, which is the wall at the end of the room. And it's like it has a different effect on our nervous system that we don't get. And even if you go outside for an hour or two, you don't get, because it takes like multiple days for some type of, I don't want to say it's like a reset, but it almost feels like it's just this like slow, like drawing back to like a real baseline, like of like the human experience that we don't feel. 10 days sounds intimidating. So on these, when you say you're meditating like all day, you're like seated for basically all day, except for maybe some like to get up to go get a meal or use a bathroom.
Each sit is an hour. So yeah, it's like eight, 9 hours of sitting. So that is part of the challenges, to be able to sit for that long. And something that I have at home, like I don't have furniture at home and just live on the floor, eat on the floor.
No way.
Right now I'm...
That's hardcore choice.
I've got my meditation platform here. So like, even though I'm at my desk, like I'm in meditation position right now. So then like, I'm just training my body to like enjoy, you know, like I don't enjoy being in chairs. Like my back hurts in chairs. My back is really good when I'm not in a chair. So like that's where I've got to. So certainly like starting off, some of the big challenge for someone doing a Vipassana is being able to work with the pain. Then actually realizing that can be part of the awakening journey, where previously, you know, we're always running away from pain, avoiding it. Can I be with this to turn towards it? Okay, what am I actually feeling? And then the magic insight is that pain arises and it passes and it can dissipate. Sometimes it won't dissipate, but there can be some really powerful experiences. And coming back to the retreat, it is an ancient intuition to retreat. And that is the word, like to step out, retreat back into coming home to oneself. And yeah, we've got big challenges today of just, the agitation of modern society. And yet there's also agitation of the mind that's been around, you know, as long as we've been human. The monkey mind, the Buddhists call it, the ordinary mind, the Taoists call it. And it's something that we need to work with as human beings. So there's always been monastics that have wanted to step out and to find clarity. So yeah, I do believe it is important on one's journey, if one is serious about the process of waking up, is to retreat. And you know, one of my things I'm really passionate about is bringing easy practices into our everyday life. So like the track snack, have a movement snack. That's a really fun one as well. Like when you have a tea break, have a chi break. So, you know, get up and do just 5 breaths of Qigong movement or have a dance. 5 breaths generally is a really beautiful morsel of mindfulness. So these are some of the key practices that I share. But that said, yeah, like also take the time. Like, so Vipassana, what they recommend is once a year. And 10 days is quite intimidating and it's hard. You know, it's like definitely some of the most challenging things I've done, but also some of the most life-changing.
That's great. No furniture. I'm impressed. You know, it's funny. I also, like, I don't like chairs. I think they're, you know, you look outside, you don't see chairs growing out of the ground. It's not what I would call natural. And I think connecting with the floor is like how you tune the body up for the day. I think there's so much value just being on the floor. I've worked in a gym environment and have trained people movement for a long time. And every session is like 15 to 20 minutes on the floor first, just to get things to kind of, I guess, connect with really foundational human patterns that we all seem to share, that we develop in like the first year of our life, like things you see babies doing. And I feel like if there's like a fountain of youth, from a movement perspective, it's that. It's like connecting with what you did when you were, you know, at the extreme level of youthness, you know, that first year. But the body adapts too. Like you mentioned, there's, you know, there could be pain seated and it could arise and it could also dissipate. I mean, I know something that I've noticed working with people over years is like get on the floor and their instinct is to like grab a really thick, cushiony, like yoga mat or something. And then it's like they don't progress the same way. Like, no. Like, let your body feel the hard thing, and then it'll harmonize with that environment. Like, don't control the environment. Harmonize with it. And like, that's a lesson that could probably be extrapolated to like so many other things that we do in society, as far as, you know, managing our food supply or whatever, or like the way we build homes or buildings. Or but that's interesting. Like, you eliminate the choice. Taking all the furniture out of the house. That's one strategy, George.
That's it. It's like take the sweet treats out of the cupboards and it's not an option anymore. Take the chairs away and that's not an option anymore.
Now, do you live alone?
That does help. Like, you know, like I've got like one token beanbag, and then when I'd like bring a lady back for a date, it's like, well, let's both uncomfortably like snuggle on this really uncomfortable beanbag. And I wonder why I've been single for so long. So.
That's funny.
But yeah, it made me think of a Hindu story of, you know, there's thorns everywhere on the path of life, you know, sharp objects that are going to cut your feet up, and you're trying to sweep up the floor, trying to clean this path, but it's endless. There's another option: wear shoes. You know, like instead of trying to control the external world and making it perfect, what about building resilience so that even if you step on the thorn, you're safe? Same thing with the body, exactly as you've expressed. Like if you have a big comfy pillow, the body's not feeling it, and like the spine doesn't get strong from like a sofa. That's why sofas disable us and chairs disable us, is because we can just totally collapse into the sofa's embrace. Whereas, yeah, if we have to hold our own spine up, or, you know, relying on the ground, then the spine has to use its own strength in order to be comfortable and feel good.
Yeah, we need that like stimulus. It's like we're always responding to the environmental stimulus. So if you like, you know, you sit in a couch for 7 hours or whatever, like you become couch-like, you become shaped like that. And you could kind of visually see it. I mean, my gym is in an office building, and you'll see, you know, over the years, you see people coming in, and they're all different ages of like people that work at desks. You know, you have the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and at every like generation, you see the progression, like how long you could kind of look at someone like this is somebody that's been sitting at a desk for 40 years, 30 years, 20, you know, and you see the architectural changes where, you know, the physical body turns into be more chair shaped, you know, cashew shaped or whatever. So we're always so and, you know, you can't avoid that totally. I guess you can if you're you could just take all the options away. But for many people, you know, you just looking at it where like, well, let me decrease the minutes of the week that I'm in like a negative environment, and not to like cast judgment on it as negative, but in an environment that doesn't really align with maybe something you care about, like feeling good in your body physically, and then just slowly increase the number of minutes that you're in a positive environment, like where you're, you know, figuring out how to sit up upright, or, you know, with those snacks that you talk about, those little like sprinkling it into your lifestyle where you have more positive things.
Because I do a lot of laptop work. And so, you know, like that is the reality of many, many jobs today. And so it's like, you know, chairs and tables. Like, so like, can you put your laptop on something where you can stand up? So you've got a standing desk, or invest in a standing desk. Then can you, when you're on your phone, stand up, maybe go into a deep squat. Then you're actually, yeah, really working on the body. If you need some support, hold on to a banister, and then you can be texting on your phone. Then movement snacks. So now my body intuitively gets me up and I crawl like a monkey, or I do some press ups or some yoga or some qigong, or I just stand up and just breathe. And my body intuitively will invite me to do that without me needing to use timers. But I did for years, I used the Pomodoro technique where I put on a 25 minute timer and then I'd stand up for a minute or two every 25 minutes. And so then once we're in that habit, another thing is, you know, you can tick. I would have some exercises, like 5 exercises to do during the day, and then give myself a tick, that dopamine hit every time I did it. And so that would be, you know, 5 movement snacks would be the aim for the day.
Yeah, that seems like a very useful strategy, especially for someone that has, you know, a lot on their to-do list every day. And smaller doses might be easier to manage, even if it's just like managing mentally, like the belief that you could squeeze stuff in and not so overwhelming as like doing an hour session. So a lot of your movement background from this, what came from the experience learned at a Tai Chi school that you thought was a Kung Fu school. So I guess Tai Chi is one of your staple practices.
Yeah.
So we've had a couple people on the podcast talking about Qigong, and I have a little bit of experience with that, but I've never really dove into Tai Chi. I assume that the Qi and Qigong and the Qi and Tai Chi, I would assume, is pointing to the same thing.
Actually not, interestingly.
Learn me something.
Yeah. So in Chinese, Tai Chi is actually Tai Chi, J-I. So it's only actually because we spelt basically a lot of the language wrong. So for example, Taoism, sometimes spelt Taoism, well, that's the dominant spelling, actually is pronounced in Chinese Dao Jia, Dao, Dao with a D. Tofu, it's actually Dofu in Chinese. So that's one example of where we've done the spelling differently. Then with Tai Chi, it's Tai Chi. So what's Qigong and what's Tai Chi? So Qi is energy, also a double meaning, the breath, which is pretty interesting. So it's life force energy, the energy that powers the universe, and the breath, same word, showing how important they thought the breath was. And then Gong is practice. So energy practice or breath practice is Qigong. Then what's Tai Chi? So Tai means supremely big, the biggest. And then Ji is principle. So Tai Chi is actually Tai Chi Chuan. So the supreme principle boxing. Chuan is boxing or fist. So my translation of Tai Chi is a supremely harmonious movement. It's then a type of Qigong. So Qigong is breath practice or energy practice. Tai Chi or Tai Chi Chuan is a type of Qigong. It fits within it. What is Tai Chi Chuan? It's a moving meditation coming from the martial art culture where we imagine that there's many different attackers attacking us from many different directions, and then gracefully and slowly we destroy them. And in so doing, as my Tai Chi master, Master Goose, says, Tai Chi is powerful, peaceful, and beautiful. Powerful, it's a martial art. You have strong legs and you become strong through the practice. Peaceful, it's a moving meditation. Beautiful, it's like a dance. And for me, I always felt like I had a dancer within me, but I didn't have the vocabulary to express myself with. Then I found Tai Chi and Qigong, and it helped me come out of my mind. I was so disembodied, like many of us, and to come into the body, realizing this is a place that I could hang out, a refuge, and not only that, a friend, not only that, a teacher, a source of a lot of wisdom for me to tap into my intuitive wisdom. So yeah, many, many things that these practices have given me.
Interesting. So I just assumed when I saw it practice, and yeah, it's visually very aesthetic to watch, you know, especially an experienced practitioner at work, but I assumed that there was still some of that like cultivation of that life force, qi energy, but you're saying that's not part of it.
So absolutely. So Qigong is a, Tai Chi is a subset of Qigong.
Okay.
So it's still energetic practice. So the breath, like yoga, you're moving with the breath. And then in a basic sense, we are doing a down-regulated rest and digest breath. So breathing down into what the Chinese call the dantian. So releasing tension, having the big qi belly, allowing ourselves to be big and being in our full power. Because when we release tension, we don't hold ourselves in. Then we access the full potential of our lungs. And through the rest and digest nervous system, we calm our nervous system. Then from there, we can also then begin to have the more subtle energy flows where we can begin to breathe energy through the body, choosing where to direct that energy. And you can get, you know, very deep and very, very esoteric with this. You know, through my own experience, I am more and more feeling that distribution of energy. And how I simply think about it is intention. So, you know, if I place my awareness on my fingertips, then I will begin to connect with the sensations that are there. My foot right now is on the ground giving me sensations that now I'm holding both my foot and my hand at the same time. So where we direct our intention, that's then when we feel sensation or energy. You know, coming back to consciousness, this field of awareness, we can choose where to direct our attention. And as the Taoists say, where intention goes, energy flows. So then if I have my awareness at my dantian, just below my belly button, and breathe down to there, and then as I breathe out, imagine myself sending all of this energy out of me. First benefit is that I am getting the alignment in the martial arts, right? Because moving from the center has this spiraling energy that makes my Tai Chi more powerful. Secondly, I'm becoming more sensitive to the body. So like in Vipassana, we talked about earlier, realizing that, yeah, we can place our awareness, we can choose where to put it, then I become more sensitive. Then thirdly, in a more energetic sense, then I'm circulating energy. And for the Taoists, this is how then we cultivate vital life force energy. And you can get kind of esoteric about it, but there is an energy that powers our universe. The more skillfully we understand how we work, then the more we can feel energized in our lives.
That sounds awesome. I feel inspired to want to learn more and dive into that practice. So I know you are not just a documentary maker. You offer other services too. Is teaching Tai Chi one of them? Or?
Yeah, so I hold retreats now all around the world. Awaken Your Potential. If people type in balanceispossible.com, they can find our events. And yeah, they're super awesome, bringing the digital into the physical. We move together, explore ideas together. Then there's also Master Goose Tai Chi Academy, where I also have my teaching on there as well. So I'm the filmmaker that has brought Master Goose teachings onto the internet. Taoistwellness.online. Taoistwellness.online is, yeah, a yearly subscription. You get to support me and my team, Balance is Possible. We're on a mission to inspire balance for people on planet and get access to Master Goose teachings as well as my own.
Okay. So it's like a membership model where you can learn. Okay. Are there any other services or things that you folks provide that you want to plug here?
Yeah. I mean, the newsletter on the way, weekly ideas for balanced living, and yeah, check out the YouTube channel. I'd love people to watch the film as well, 45 minutes, The Subtle Art of Losing Yourself. And yeah, fun thing to put on one evening.
Well, George, I want to thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I know we got a late start, and I want to honor your time here. And yeah, for the audience, check it out, Subtle Art of Losing Yourself. And that YouTube channel is, it's just your name, right? George Thompson?
George Thompson, yeah.
Yeah, it's great way to spend 45 minutes. It's beautiful, and it's a great message, and hopefully you'll get some inspiration out of it. Anything else you'd like to add, George, before we wrap this up?
Grateful for your presence and, yeah, sense your care and wanting to inspire people with movement, which I think is so important. So, yeah, grateful to connect and just sending my best wishes to all of our beautiful viewers and listeners. You can do it. Peace is possible. Balance is possible. Practice is the path.
That's well said. Well, thanks again for listening, everybody. I hope you got some enjoyment out of this. Always grateful for your listening. And George, once again, thanks. It was great to connect with you. Have a good day, everybody.